Good evening. You're all very welcome tonight to this forum event. It's lovely to see so many of you here. The forum is a non-profit organisation dedicated to getting academic philosophers and other thinkers out from their ivory tower to discuss their ideas and their work with a general audience, and to hopefully increase the standard of public debate, which I think you'll probably agree is much needed at the time being. Just a few housekeeping rules or ideas. If you could turn the volume off on your phone, that would be fantastic. There's no need to turn your phone off, though you're welcome to tweet along with us. The hashtag is LSEFEP. This will be recorded for a podcast, so if you ask a question, do be aware your voice will be recorded. And do wait for the roving mic to find you so that your voice is picked up on the podcast and so everyone else can hear you. The forum's work is supported by donors and the LSE, and we're very grateful for the support that we get. If you too would like to support us, you can find a link to our Just Giving page on our website. There you'll also find a whole host of podcasts of our earlier events, as well as essays by contemporary philosophers on their work. As you'll see, I've passed out a questionnaire. If you could fill it out and just leave it on the table when you're done, we can collect it at the end of the event. Okay, that's enough from me. I'll hand you over to our chair for tonight, Peter Dennis.
Well, good evening and welcome to this Forum for European Philosophy event on the worst form of government, or I should say the worst form of government, question mark. We're delighted to have with us Beatrix Campbell, who's a writer and activist, one-time member of the Communist Party, and she's also stood for election at least once for the Green Party. We have Peter Hallwood, who's professor in modern European philosophy at Kingston University, and Edward Canterian, who's senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Kent. Tonight we're going to be discussing two main questions. First of all, what is democracy? And under that heading, what does it contrast with? Is democracy just a descriptive concept, or is it best understood as an ideal that we should be working towards? Equally, what's the relationship between democracy and other kind of related ideas like liberty or capitalism? And the second main question we'll be discussing is, what are the arguments for democracy? Can democracy be defended against the sceptic? Someone would say that, someone who would say that democracy is not the best form of government. What are its strengths and weaknesses, and what method are we supposed to use anyway in order to assess them? And between the different questions, I'll be taking some questions from the audience, so feel free to raise your hand. I'll just say, if you want to ask a question, please wait for the microphone to come to you. The event is being recorded for a podcast, and we want to have your questions on the podcast as well. Before we get into those two questions, though, I want to spend quite a bit of time talking about the different members of the panel's experience with democracy. There is a wealth of experience with democracy on the panel, and so I'd like to do that first. It's something perhaps we don't often do in a philosophical debate of this type. We're more interested in exchanging evidence and arguments and objections to positions. But let's start with that question first of all. And Beatrix, if we can start with you, what is your democracy experience?
I have two kinds, I think, of democracy experience. One is, I vote, and I have almost nothing to say about the experience of voting. It's odd. You walk into this place, you long to have conversations with people who are queuing up as you are, and then you go into this thing alone and make a decision. And I've never, I think, made the decision where that cross went that really had any consequences at all. And I've certainly never had the experience of voting for a party that I really, really liked that won, ever. So that bit of my democratic experience is a bit impoverished. But some of the episodes in my life that have been intense experiences of democracy. First of all, the Communist Party, which I was in from when I was 16 till it died. And I belonged to that bit of the Communist Party that was anti-Stalinist, anti-Soviet, became in the 1960s engaged in student politics. I wasn't, because I wasn't a student. But then in feminist politics, and feminism was a really scalding, florid challenge to the some of the kind of biblical standards of democratic structure in the Communist Party. Hugely pyramidical, hierarchical, quite authoritarian, and the feminist presence in the Communist Party in Britain in the 1970s was marvellously unruly and really naughty. Didn't give a... We didn't. And that was because our... I'll say something about that in a minute, but I want to say something about the being a communist and being anti-Stalinist. Unlike the rest of the left, and particularly the revolutionary left, which flourished wonderfully in the 1960s and 70s, communists were the only lot who'd participated in the construction of states. And all of them were tyrannical, difficult, ultimately unsupportable. And so communists of my generation, and indeed the generation before, were endlessly living with a kind of settling of accounts with the Soviet and Chinese experience, hugely involved in quite passionate critiques of it. And our project was how to redeem Marxist-inspired, radical, revolutionary activism, class politics, socialist politics, from the scandal and shock of the Soviet and Chinese experiments. And of course, ultimately, we failed. But that was, I would say, maybe half of the membership of the Communist Party was engaged in that enterprise. How to redeem the Communist project from the experience of these two great state blocs in the 20th century. The other really thrilling, dangerously thrilling experience of democracy for me was the Women's Liberation Movement, which was a very different kind of ethos of political activism and engagement with being a person, being a citizen. It didn't start from the premise that you were, as it were, immaculately conceived, a ready-made agent of social change with a portfolio that you were born with. The only, in my case, bit of the portfolio that we were born with that really mattered in the Communist Party was class, which I think is still irreducibly important. It doesn't really have a vocabulary any longer in our society, except as a kind of site of mockery and denigration anymore. But within feminism is a culture that starts from the experience of subordination, how to be insubordinate, how to even know what your subordinate condition is. What the hell is it? What is the source of your pain? It's crucially interested in what it means to be subordinate. There is nothing heroic. There is nothing comfortable. There is nothing sorted about the condition of oppression because of its, obviously its social and systemic regimes, but the ways in which that experience of inequality and oppression is lived inside your skin, inside your psyche. And so how to construct a politics that facilitates, that creates the conditions in which you can be released. So feminism is about collective self-discovery, the pain of that, the processes of recovery from that, and the thrill of solidarity. And it borrows much of its language and ethos, crucially, from the great black civil rights movements in the United States. I've been reading a lot recently about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the culture of divine solidarity and community, as they thought about it, which is worth revisiting. So I won't go on more, save to say that the really scary but thrilling thing about feminism is that it is both about the production or reconception of yourself, the making of yourself, because where you start from is not where you want to be, if you're a woman, and how that translates into a shared collective enterprise. What kind of questions does that throw up?
I want to move on to Edward in a minute, but before I do, if I could ask you just to elaborate on what you were saying with your experience with the Communist Party. You said there was a need to redeem the essence of communism as an idea from the ways in which it had been tried in the Soviet Union and in China. Of course, one criticism that people make is that people in the Communist Party didn't believe in democracy. Would that be a kind of true criticism? Was it true that many people in that movement didn't think that democracy was the best way to organise a state, and they had an alternative vision of things?
Well, I think there are two answers to that. One is that some didn't. My parents thought there was nothing more important than defending the worker state, and nothing more important than understanding there are two sides, and they are them and us. And us equals the majority. And, you know, what is done in the name of us is correct. Our family's huge combustions were on the terrain of Russia and Stalin, let me tell you. So, for them, of course, that was anchored in an experience of the 1920s and 30s, the Second World War, and an experience of subordination described as class that was inscribed in humiliation. Okay, but for the rest who were not of that view, the challenge to Stalinism was driven by a democratic imperative and the wish to confront the vocabulary of Marxism that lent itself to the anti-democratic esprit, if you like, of the Soviet Union. And in Europe in the 1960s, and the Communist Party of Britain was engaged in this, was trying to discover a way of being engaged in democratic politics that was not exhausted by the idea of parliamentary politics. This is something which prevails as an argument still today. So communists would be involved in all manner of anti-oppressive social movements that were necessarily in their inner life about the practice of democracy, because they were about the empowerment of people. If you were a minority party, a titchy little party like the Communist Party, you couldn't really boss people about. You didn't have the power to do that. So the democratic road to socialism was what communists in the 1960s and 1970s were really, really interested in.
Fantastic. Edward, can I bring you in here? Because
yes,
you have a rather different experience of democracy.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you very much, Beatrix, for already fantastic first entry. I hope we won't talk just about communism today, but here are four experiences with democracy I have had in my life so far. The very first one is right now here, the whole of you. The liberty of assembly is, of course, a liberal democratic value. So the very fact that you are all here and have assembled freely is already speaking in favor of democracy. We can finish the conversation. We can finish the discussion. Democracy has won. So that's the first very straightforward experience. The second one will have to rewind a bit and go back into my childhood. I was born in Romania, in communist Romania, at the end of the 1960s. And if I invite you, if you ever go for a trip to Eastern Europe, go also to Romania and go to Bucharest, to the capital. And if you have a bit of free time, go to the Armenian cemetery in Bucharest. I am half Armenian. And go and look up my name, Edward Kantarian, exactly my name as it is spelled here in the entry of the graves available there. And you'll find a grave called Edward Kantarian, my uncle, who in 1950 was shot by the communist border guards when he tried to escape the country as a young man of 17. So that's my second negative indirect experience of democracy, namely lack of it. The third of it is I emigrated with my parents and my sister at the beginning of the 1980s, so way before, a few years before the Perestroika and Glasnost, to Western Germany, to Munich. And soon in school, we had in the history lesson several weeks in which we discussed the German guilt in the Second World War and the crimes perpetrated against the Jews and the Gypsies and Romas. And that was my third very important decisive experience of democracy, this time again positive, like the first one, because I realized that I am now in a country in which I can speak freely, and I'm educated, in fact, and taught to critically reflect upon the dark pasts of my nation, which I was not allowed, not entitled to do at all in communist Romania. And the fourth, my fourth experience, again, a very recent one, yesterday, I live in, 2 days ago, I live in Brussels, so, and I commute to University of Kent. I bumped into our strip sweeper, a young man from Ethiopia, and I told him that I'll have a conversation here at the LSE about democracy, and I asked him, what do you think of democracy, good or bad? Give me an elevator pitch. And he immediately made a distinction out of the blue. He said, well, are you asking me about democracy as it is right now lived in different countries, or are you asking me about democracy in principle? I said, both. He said, well, with respect to the first, I would say that democracy is right now not doing very well in many countries all over the globe. Obviously an informed man. But with respect to democracy as a principle, he said, I am emphatically in favor of it. And then I asked him why. And the word he immediately blurted out was liberty. And the second thing he said is, I don't want my life to be dictated by some tyrannical regime, by some dictator who tells me what to do and not what not to do. And the promise of democracy is precisely that, liberty. It doesn't just come as liberty of voting, liberty of assembly, and liberty of religion, of faith. It also comes, and here we might disagree, or I might disagree with some of you, as liberty of possessing property. In fact, that's a right to possess property, which can lead to free trade and to prosperity and wealth. At least these are my four experiences.
Thanks. Peter?
We'll have to come back to the relation between democracy and liberalism, or liberal freedoms, I think, in a moment. But my personal experience of state democracy, say the kind of democracy you started out by talking about, Beatrix, is virtually nil. For me, growing up in the neoliberal era, voting was essentially a choice between variations on a single model. Countries like the United States or Britain have been, in my experience, essentially forms of a single-party state, and the consensus around that there is no alternative has been almost entirely hegemonic. Perhaps until recently, I think what's happening with Corbyn, what's happening with Podemos in Spain, these are genuinely hopeful developments, and things are perhaps beginning to shift. On the other hand, democracy properly means the power or the rule of the people, if you go back to the etymology. And I've certainly had some experience of popular power or popular empowerment, but in a pretty marginal or ephemeral way. So moments of collective organization, typically in student-led mobilizations or some trade union experiences, things like that. And I think if we're to recover something of the notion of democracy, we have to start out from that. What are the processes of popular empowerment, building indeed on things like a capacity to assemble and associate I just finished by saying that that wasn't necessarily a liberal freedom, already trying to disagree a little bit here with Edward, because for a while, liberal freedoms, in fact, precluded the right of, say, workers to combine or to assemble, and that the notion of freedom, individual freedom, was set up in opposition to democratic forms like popular assembly. But we'll need to perhaps come back to that.
Okay, thank you very much. So three very rich and varied experiences of democracy. I want to bring in the audience. If you have a question or comment that you would like to make, please raise your hand and we will try to get a microphone to come to you. There's a gentleman I can see already on the left with his hand up, sort of the middle row. Keep your hands up so that I can see you. We'll try to take two or three.
Hello, I've got a question to Dr. Kantarian. And you said that you think that this meeting and possibly of public meetings open to all of us is a success of democracy. And I want to ask you, do you think that everyone can be here? I mean, of course, there are no legal restrictions to come there, but I think that there's a lot of people excluded from the society. And I want to ask you, do you believe in democracy without equality?
So the question is whether everybody has time to come here, or that whether people are prevented from coming here. What exactly is your question here? Because I don't see how anybody in this society is, in principle, legally prevented from turning up here.
Of course, nobody is legally prevented, but
that's all we care about in liberalism first, right? We care about the general freedom that we have. The next question is whether physically, contingently, all of us are capable of attending any meeting. I mean, imagine there is another lecture about the same topic in Edinburgh right now. I cannot be there because I'm here. So that's not what you have in mind. What else do you have in mind?
So my main question is, do you believe in democracy with inequality in a society? In the world where 50 people have the same amount of assets as the half of the world, yeah?
Yeah, so now you are asking me that's a separate question. That's not connected to being prevented or allowed to turn up to this debate. Now you are asking me a question about what sort of social policy we should have, whether there should be a welfare state. I mean, that's a separate question. Do you want my political views on that? Or what? I tend to be on the social liberal side of things, more towards the center, if that makes you happy. So that I'm fine with that, and I am in favor of equality, of course, in this respect. But we are speaking about equality before the law. That's a separate issue, right?
Okay. There's another question. There's a lady.
Sorry
in
about
the
this.
Middle, kind of in the middle row, towards the front. Put your hand right up.
You spoke about the link between democracy and liberty. How do you think the idea of the tyranny of the majority has an influence in this conversation and in the ideas?
Okay. Let's take a couple of questions in succession, because I think that could be a general question for any of the panel might chime in on that. There's a gentleman on the other side of this big section of seats. Yes.
Thank you. This is a question that's indirectly to Dr. Kantarian, but it applies to everyone, and it sort of relates to what the gentleman over there asked. I was wondering, it seems to me, and I think the current events are strengthening my position on that issue, is that for democracy to work in appropriately, you need people to be educated, to understand what's around them, and to then act in what we would assume are rational manners. Do you think that democracy, if we look at the education of the people, or as communists would say, the masses, do you think that democracy could ever be reached, and should it ever be reached? That is, should everyone have the same ability of the highest level of education in order to make rational choices?
Sorry, I missed your last sentence. Your last sentence, acoustically.
Just repeat the last sentence, because it was difficult for us to hear.
My question is, do you think that it is possible to reach democracy in the sense that everyone would get the highest level of education in order to make rational choice, and should it be achieved?
Okay, great. And again, let's just take one final question. We'll take these three questions together. Somebody over this side. Yeah, there's a lady right there.
You spoke about voting being your experience of democracy, and I was just wondering whether you think, given that we only vote once every 4 years, and that the period in between could effectively be termed like a dictatorship because it's a government that is allowed to continue 4 years, so do we always live in a democracy, or do we only actually have democracy when we vote once every 4 years?
Okay, brilliant. So we've got three questions then on the table. One question is how to distinguish a democracy from the tyranny of the majority. The other question is, will citizens ever reach a level of education that's necessary in order to participate in a democracy? And the final question is about voting. If we only vote once every 4 years, do we live in a democracy every 4 years? Perhaps if I could give the tyranny of democracy question to Peter, you might want to take that. Edward to talk about education, and Beatrix on voting, since you mentioned it.
And do you, well, the question of the tyranny of the majority is very relevant, I think. I think democracy can indeed be experienced as a kind of tyranny by the few. In other words, by a privileged elite, and it has regularly been experienced in that form by people whose interests can be threatened, basically, by the interests of the majority. And so historically, to make a point that would have been so obvious you wouldn't need to make it, but historically there was a massive and obvious difference in principle between an aristocracy and a democracy, and you could throw in a monarchy as well. You have that's the traditional triad. So the rule is either that of a single person or a few people, mainly rich people, you know, authorized, entitled people, or the majority of people. And Plato and Aristotle would often add the many or the poor. And so really until the French Revolution, democracy meant the rule of the many and of the poor, and was often associated with a form of mob rule or a kind of tyrannical, impulsive, impetuous mass of ignorant people who would indeed threaten the interests of relatively wealthy, relatively privileged people. So when Tocqueville and many others, you know, worry about this question, or say the founders of the American Constitution, Hamilton, Madison, all these people are very profoundly aristocratic thinkers, and they are indeed obsessed with this fear and this concern and this question. And in a certain sense, they were right to be. The beginnings of democracy in a meaningful sense, a mass empowerment on a serious scale, I think there are precursors to this in, say, the English Revolution and even in episodes of the American Revolution. But it really takes off, I think, with the French Revolution, and in particular the second more radical phase of the French Revolution, when indeed there is mass empowerment in the streets of Paris and elsewhere in the country. And one of the things that the new popular power does is threaten aristocratic and clerical privileges and many other things. And that history then runs its course. And I think you could say, without going into the voting question, that the reduction of democracy to an electoral charade, essentially, is part of the way of coping with the threat of the tyranny of the majority. Just like the you know, to use it in a somewhat associated term, that the old notion of a dictatorship of the proletariat, or the idea that popular power could impose itself in ways that might trample on the privileges or rights of the few, was again, you know, one of the ways of dissolving this was to deflect the question away from popular empowerment and onto questions of forms of representation. How should people be represented? How should they be represented fairly? How should all the different social interests that make up a supposedly harmonious, complex social organism, you know, with its different classes and different positions, how should all of those positions be represented fairly and evenly so that you minimize the social friction and, by the by, so that you preserve the privileges and so on of those at the top of that social pyramid? And I think that's been a big part of the way that democracy has been incorporated into a fundamentally oligarchic or even, you know, broadly aristocratic social model in a way that would have been very unthinkable, I think, back in, say, the earlier part of the 18th century or before then.
Well, you mentioned voting, so let's bring Beatrix in on that. That's the question. It seems to kind of that perhaps that resonates with you, this experience of voting as something like a tick box affair that you do once every 4 years.
I want to have a little swerve in response to that, and to think about two moments of voting that are not about that 4 year or 5 year cycle that we in these islands have got recent experience of: the Brexit vote and the Scottish referendum vote. They're very interesting to compare. And I want to go back a little bit with the Scottish referendum, because we who live in England really haven't a clue what happened in Scotland, why it happened, what the history of it was, and what that referendum felt like. We know very well what our referendum, and it was primarily an English referendum, on Brexit, felt like. It was horrible. Okay, go back a bit. One of my early experiences of democracy was the campaign for nuclear disarmament and the march in 1961 when I was 14, which was a huge march from the bomb-making factory at Aldermaston to London. And my little contingent from a little border town was adjacent to a huge and noisy contingent who were the Govan and Gorbals Young Socialists. Now, the thing that was significant about them is that they were part of the beginning of what we now recognise as, you know, the Scottish national moment. Why? Because America was planting, with Westminster's agreement, nuclear missiles in Holyrood. And there was huge resistance to this. And indeed, some Scottish National Party veterans marked the moment of the beginning of this referendum then, when Polaris missiles arrived in Holyrood. It was also the moment of a huge, fabulous cultural renaissance in Scotland. And we had some experience of it with the Govan and Gorbals Young Socialist contingent behind us, who sang. They were shipyard apprentices, secretaries, and singers. And the importance of that, the reason why we need to get a grip of this, is because the huge peace movement in Scotland connected with a national sensibility which was completely different from England. It was one in which the majority class felt itself to be the nation. Okay, then we have the election of Margaret Thatcher and Scotland's experience of an eternal democratic deficit. They didn't elect Tories in Scotland. They didn't vote for Thatcherism. And by the end of the reign of Thatcherism, Labour really, which is a party of unionism, it's not a party that's interested very much in decentralising power in these islands, found itself with no alternative but to concede devolution in Scotland. And the interesting thing about where we then get to with the vote on independence is that Scotland engaged in a dense, intimate, interested, educated conversation about what democracy should be, what it wasn't, why it mattered, what the consequences might be of this or that option. Families argued the toss. People set up little stalls at the bus station, down the bottom of the street, just because people were riveted. They were thrilled to be part of that conversation. The vote was enormous, and indeed Scotland continues to be probably one of the most politically educated bits of our archipelago. Compare that to the Brexit vote, which everybody agrees was degraded. Degraded. Full of lies and deception. It appeared to be about one thing. In fact, viscerally, it was about something else. And something else that dared not speak its name became flushed with excitement. Anti-immigration feeling, racism, all masquerading in "I want my country back." And I thought to myself, my country? Did I ever own my country? Is this my country? In what sense is it my country? It's where I live. Doesn't make it mine. Not if you're my sex, my sexual orientation, my class, for the last year on year since 1980, inequality has grown in my country. I don't like it. I don't want it to be mine. So we all know that the Brexit conversation was rough, rude, nasty, and unhelpful. And it produced an outcome that is very shocking. We are faced with something very shocking about ourselves. Scotland doesn't have that experience. I'm not saying that Scotland is, you know, heaven on earth. But the two experiences of something that notionally is the same, a vote, a referendum, could not be more different. So it tells us something about the conversation about democracy can't just be about voting and parliaments. It is about the quality of the national conversation and the quality of everybody's participation in and feeling that they can participate in the national conversation.
Edward, democracy yes. and education.
Well, yes, you have already anticipated my main points as well. So you mentioned the quality of democratic participation. So there is a distinction that we need to make between formal democracy and substantive democracy, and this distinction is made in political theory. So according to a formal understanding of democracy, we are just looking at the setup of rules, electoral rules, etc., in a state, whereas substantive democracy is something much less tangible, much less easy to grasp, and it connects essentially to a flourishing political life and culture in a society. The question is, how are we supposed to kickstart this again? It's true that in Western countries, we are increasingly experiencing voter fatigue, depression, lack of interest, political indifference. Some people say that this is simply related to the fact that our societies are more or less doing okay. Others say, no, there is here a very serious problem going on. For the more advanced, the more liberal a society becomes, well, what does that mean, the more liberal it becomes? Well, it means that the more every individual citizen realizes the ideal of freedom and liberty within himself or herself. But that then means, sooner or later, some development of atomization. I am seeing my own self-interest as opposed to the interest of the others. We are going back to the Hobbesian state of nature. Then the next question is, if that is the late stage of a liberal democracy, what might come next? What often comes next is a desire for unity again, of some sort. And then ideologies, often radical ideologies of unification, arise, and the need for them arise. And that's a very, very dangerous development which we are facing in the West. We are facing it in the United States. We faced it with Brexit, I think, to some extent here. We are facing it on the continent a lot. In my country of citizenship, in Germany, we are facing it with the right now, also partly the extreme left. So now coming back to the question I was asked, would education help us? First of all, you asked me whether I'm in favor of education. Obviously, emphatically, I'm an educator, so I teach at the University of Kent. Yes, I'm in favor of education. The question is, however, whether education alone can help us. I don't have a definite answer to that. That's a question that we need to all ask ourselves, how we can become politically engaged again. I can only tell you from my point of view, not from a theoretical point of view, but from a personal point of view, my students are not politically active and they are not politically interested at all. When I sometimes start a lecture by simply raising what happened in the news as an example for some philosophical problem, they look at me not knowing what I'm talking about. So what are we supposed to do that? I obviously cannot teach them all the news happening in the media. They have to do it themselves. But I'm not sure how this is supposed to be done. They might not be realizing the direction into which they, as atomized individuals, are heading with the society as a whole. So, simple answer is yes, I'm emphatically in favor of education, but in practice I'm not exactly sure how this is supposed to be achieved. Even if we make education entirely free, and I'm in favor of that, I'm from Germany, so I'm in favor of free education for everybody. But I'm not sure that's the ultimate answer.
Thanks, Edward. So we began by talking about experience of democracy, but it's a philosophy event after all, so we got quite quickly to talking about definitions and criticisms and evaluations of democracy. Let's sort of move on more to that that theme, particularly of the definition of democracy. Peter, you already began to give us or to locate democracy between monarchy and aristocracy as part of this traditional trio. Could you tell us a bit more about how you as a political philosopher would conceptualize democracy and how it should be defined?
Yeah, I think one of the functions that reference to democracy tends to make in contemporary political discussion is to blur questions of power and questions of social struggle and antagonism and so on, and to conceal all of that under this kind of liberal veneer, which you can then measure more, as Edward said, more or less formally according to, you know, different sorts of measurements. And what's less fuzzy is the question of who can command a society, who has sovereign power, to use another classical concept. And this notion of sovereignty, which is developed, you know, in the 17th century or a little before, by Baudin at the end of the 16th century, and then Hobbes and others through de Rousseau, will develop different versions of it. And the fundamental notion that at the core of it is the idea of command, that the sovereign is that instance, that actor — it could be a person, it could be a whole people, it could be a group — that has the actual power to command everybody else in the situation, including themselves. In other words, to lay down the law to everybody else and themselves. And Hobbes in particular, and Spinoza too, will stress that you need that actual capacity. If you don't actually have the power to command, then your right to be sovereign, so to speak, is itself challenged. And Rousseau will say the same thing. The fundamental question is, do the people have that power or not? You would have popular sovereignty then in a situation where people in fact have done what is required to acquire that capacity. In other words, the ability to organize, to inform themselves, to debate, to deliberate, to assemble, to direct, you know, their decision-making in certain ways, and then to enforce it. And that's the critical question for me, is what is that? You know, how do we make sense of all those capacities? How do we judge our own, you know, our own ability to acquire them? And how do we want to deploy them? It could be as anodyne as saying, well, there's broadly popular support for a ban on smoking or for maintaining a national health system, which is a form of unity after all. Or there might be, you know, a battle going on about whether there should be basically comprehensive education or a much more hierarchical form. But these are the kinds of debates that split societies and around which I think you have a kind of democratic option insofar as the interests of the great majority of people is indeed expressed, formulated, and imposed. And that's broadly the question that I think is at stake, and it's the question that has haunted first initially explicitly counter-revolutionary thought and then broadly liberal thought, I think, for the last 200 years. How to make sure that threat remains virtual or disempowered, how to ensure that people are dispersed, atomized, maintained in states of relative ignorance or misinformation, relative forms of miseducation, you know, and that are challenged. As a result, people indeed are disaffected, relatively ignorant, can't be bothered with politics, because why would you waste your time with something so futile? And that is a very good question. And people who don't vote, for example, in the United States, are massively people who realize that it's not in their interest to vote, or that there's nothing for them to vote for. That's not to say that those people, though, can't acquire a capacity to organize, as has happened repeatedly in the history of that country. And that is the challenge that I think we're left with now.
So would it be correct to say that, according to you, that democracy is when the people have sovereignty, that ultimate power to command,
yes,
as you put it?
That's right. That's what the rule of the people means if we take it seriously, yeah.
And could I connect that then with something that you said in the beginning in your introductory remarks, when you said, well, actually, I don't have very much experience of democracy. Are you suggesting that, you know, in fact, we don't really live in a situation where the people have sovereignty? Because I can imagine that there may be people in the audience who are sort of confused, and they may be wondering, well, hang on, we've just had this referendum where the British people have asserted their sovereignty. Would you say that's not a...
I don't think they did. So Brexit, I wrote a little something about this, and it's hard to summarize the arguments, but I don't think it was a case of popular sovereignty because the debate was indeed divisive, misinformed, deflected in different ways. Rousseau has a useful distinction that those of you who have studied political philosophy will be very familiar with, between saying that there's a kind of aggregate opinion or a will of all, as he puts it. You know, and you have an aggregate opinion on any question you like. We could ask a whole bunch of sort of opinion poll style questions to this audience and add up the different votes, and we would have an opinion about, you know, are there too many immigrants in Britain, or should we abolish grammar schools? Whatever question you like. That doesn't give you a sovereign decision. It doesn't give you what Rousseau calls a general will. In other words, a willing or a collective decision-making that is actually implemented, that is put into practice through debate and discussion so that you arrive at a kind of common will, a common will to impose a certain project. You get that, for example, in a trade union or in a political party when you arrive at a decision, whether to go on strike, whether to take this or that position on a policy debate. But I think Brexit, although there were some elements of that, certainly, I think overall I don't think it did meet those criteria, and therefore, unlike the referendum in Scotland or some that happened previously in Quebec or other places, I don't think it really was a very good instance of sovereign power. I think it was an expression very largely of massive discontent with the new liberal project of the last 30 or so years and its consequences, which have been, you know, very, very painfully suffered in many parts of the country, as is now, I think, been pretty comprehensively shown.
Beatrix, would you agree with that if we define democracy as the people possessing absolute sovereignty and having the ability to command and make their laws, on that definition, we don't currently live in a democracy?
I think that's right. I mean, it's a tricky argument to make in the sense that, what is it that we're in? We're in something that calls itself a democracy. But its characteristics seem to have become preoccupied with minimising the possibilities of dissent, hegemonising a language, I mean, will be familiar to all of you, of there is no alternative. There is only one way. There isn't a third way. There never was a third way. There aren't two ways, there's only one way, the neoliberal way. And that has produced a collapse, a kind of anti-politics, anti-democracy. No wonder there's a kind of ennui and disappointment and depression, because there is no possibility of imagining alternatives that actually, of course, are about real, structural problems of power. So the great challenge is to forgive me for being a bit coarse, but to capitalism, let's say, have been defeated for about 30 years. The means of neighbourhoods organising resistance to Westminster's injunctions have been defeated. The last great democratic enterprise in Britain at the level of municipal activity was the Greater London Council, and the government just abolished it. It just abolished it. It was an extraordinary and astounding thing to do. And it abolished it precisely because it was about the Greater London Council experiment, if you like, was about the Labour Party doing something it hasn't done for a very, very long time, which is expanding the constituencies of interest that whose interests it will articulate and navigate. Abolished. We live in a profoundly undemocratic culture. And something very interesting is happening now, which is a sense that actually enough already. This is a disaster, and there are examples across a few little borders of something else going on that are very alluring. I want to just throw in another little thought here, which is that I'm thinking of your work, Peter, and the question of what are those moments that are experienced as the flowering of democracy, and what are their consequences? What have we learned about those insurgent moments, and then what happens? Well, of course, one kind of insurgent moment is those moments when there's an imperative to create some new constitutional settlement. In these islands, Northern Ireland is the exemplar of what happens in a long, long, long war, 30 years of war, across the Irish Sea, to stop Catholics sharing power with Protestants. That was what that was about. Extraordinary, isn't it? Our government threw millions into that enterprise. And in the end, the constitutional settlement wasn't just, as we think about it over here, ending a war, stopping paddies killing each other, which is how the Northern Ireland conflict was represented over here. It contained an extremely significant constitutional innovation that was designed to disrupt the habits of democratic practice. And the way it did that was to insert a constitutional obligation to organise and implement policy by reference to, with due regard to, its impact on certain named grounds: gender, sexual orientation, religion. There were 8, 9 grounds. And the formulation of policy had to be mindful of the implications for those constituencies of interest, and it had to carry with it a duty to do something about poverty. So that was its constitution. That was constitutionalised. Imagine that. Imagine how you get to that. And imagine what it means to then implement it, because it carries with it, all of those things, carry with it a duty to engage those with an interest in the making of the policy. So you don't just vote for it once every 4 years. You are consulted. You are invited to make a noise. You are invited to be present in the process of implementation. So that's a very different... I mean, as it happens, it's not been allowed to happen, really, for all sorts of reasons. But it's a and it arises out of... And I think it often does. It arises out of brutal conflict. Something beautiful, constitutionally, is produced. Rarely, actually, does it then live. Does it live well? But those moments of violence and then some kind of settlement that involves having to take account of those... I'm blethering now, but you know what I mean.
Thank you. So there's a bit of a consensus then emerging on this side of the panel that we don't, in any sort of strict sense of the term, live in a democracy.
Yeah.
Edward, I wonder whether you disagree with that consensus.
Yes.
You said in the beginning, you know,
I should maybe
it's
move a
victory
a bit
for
away.
Democracy.
It's a victory for democracy.
Yes, I am on the left, unfortunately.
You said we're all gathered here, freedom association.
I should move to the right. Well,
the thing is that we're nice, you see.
Yes, you are very nice.
Democracy is very nice, so you're in safe hands.
You are actually refuted by your own words, yeah. So I do have cold feet, you know, I mean... So both with you, Peter, and with you, Beatrix, you know, saying things like the Brexit referendum was not an exercise in sovereignty. First of all, the criteria for that are very strict and very clear. A referendum is not an exercise in sovereignty if its results do not satisfy me. Okay, there are technical criteria whether or not a referendum is an exercise in sovereignty in the will of the people, and it was in this respect. I didn't like the result. I hate the result. In fact, I loathe it, and I'm very worried about it. But it was an exercise in sovereignty. I'm very surprised You're saying that the people were manipulated by the media, and they were manipulated by some very dreadful characters, political characters. It's all true, but why were they manipulated? Are you telling me they're all tomatoes, passive tomatoes? Of course they are not. We live in an age of the internet. People are free to inform themselves, and they should do so. They deserve what they will get. So sovereignty doesn't necessarily mean that we get only the outcomes, the best possible outcomes of our general collective self-interest. Kant says famously, enlightenment is the liberation from self-imposed immaturity. Okay, so more or less, the Brexit voters probably were not fully mature. But who is to make them mature? Do we want to go back to a sort of paternalist state where they are made mature? Can you be made mature? Is not the idea that you make yourself mature? Is that not precisely the idea? So I am having cold feet because I'm already sensing here, if your sort of society would be installed or state would be installed, we would be all educated to vote in a certain sense. That's where you're coming from, I think. No. Just to provoke you. So I have gone through this experience, and I'm sensing. So I have a very refined antennas for this sort of discourse. So that's the first thing. The second thing, to reply to Beatrix, you said we live in a deeply unfree society. How can you say that? I mean, there are so-called democracy indices. We have discussed that before the panel. There are democracy indices. And if we look those up, we get the UK faring pretty well overall. So the top, the Champions League of democracy, according, this is done by The Economist, okay, is Norway, Iceland, Sweden, New Zealand, Denmark, Switzerland, etc. Germany placed 13, not too bad. UK 16. And who is at the bottom? And that's what matters. When we are discussing the quality of a democracy or not, we always have to look at the alternatives and not simply at the disadvantages and the bad features of our current society. We are deceived if we do that. If we are not doing a comparative method here and looking at the alternatives, both the possible alternatives and the really existing alternatives, we will be deceived to believe that we live in a deeply evil society. But it might well be that many of the disadvantages and flaws of our society, the current one, reflect flaws of human nature, and not flaws which are intrinsic to democracy alone. It might simply be the case that we are a flawed species, and the level of political perfection, the level of perfection which our political entities and states can achieve might not be that high, might not be a maximum. Communists tell us otherwise. Utopians tell us otherwise. Islamists tell us otherwise. Fascists tell us otherwise. Democrats, liberals don't tell us otherwise. Who is at the bottom of this Champions League? Can you guess? North Korea, exactly. And penultimate, Syria, but that's obvious. Chad, Central African Republic, Equatorial Guinea, Turkmenistan. Are you really comparing the United Kingdom, even after Brexit referendum, with these sort of countries? North Korea?
No.
So Beatrix and Peter must have the right of reply. Who would like to go first?
I think you're imputing something to us that we've not said. I don't think that we're not a democracy. I think we are a kind of not a very good democracy. Mm. I think there's something utterly contradictory in our culture. And it's that at one level, some of the great social movements have had astounding impact on our political institutions. But they're fragile, and our political institutions are increasingly etiolated. And so part of our difficulty, as compared to the natural comparators, who are the Northern and Northern European and Scandinavian states, is that our welfare state, which is part of the condition of a healthy democracy, because it expands the space of politics and democratic consequences, consequentialness, if you see what I mean. A reduced welfare state reduces the space of politics. And certainly for women, crucially, because the kind of resources that impact on our everyday life, our access to the means of making a difference, given that we are the poorest bit and the least resourced bit of our society, is dramatically diminished by the decline of the welfare state. So it all goes to the decline of our democracy. It all goes to that moment, I think, when neoliberalism, or the endorsement of the neoliberal project, seems to acquire the status of a kind of natural law. And New Labour's endorsement of that, and indeed Social Democratic endorsement of that across Europe, has been part of the condition of the decline of politics. Because what's politics about if it's not about the peaceful engagement across difference and the articulation of different interests and how they're going to sort out that problem of power that you alluded to? It is absolutely unquestionably the case that the majority class in Britain, my class, the class that made me, I am a child of the welfare state in Britain. I am a child of the post-war settlement and the creation of a welfare state that was an answer to a class that had to be addressed. That no longer exists. It no longer exists in Britain. So I think that is a serious, searing, humiliating blow to democracy. It doesn't mean it's dead. It just means it's deeply wounded.
Peter.
I think we have to make a distinction between a liberal regime and a democratic regime. Now, liberal democracy has become such a familiar turn of phrase, and I think for you they're broadly interchangeable. But I don't think they are. They haven't been historically, and I don't think they are in substance. We clearly live in Britain, and we're lucky to live in Britain in a liberal society. And there are liberal freedoms that I also value as much as everybody here, I imagine. People fought for them. We've acquired them. I don't think they're as secure as we perhaps sometimes imagine, but they are certainly far more secure than they are in many other parts of the world, and that's valuable and important. I don't think, though, that it's a democratic system so much as a representative system. And you had in the early years of the United States, the debates around the Constitution of the United States, also in France after the Revolution in the first part of the 19th century, you had people talk about the theories of representative government. They didn't mean democracy. They meant representation, and broadly they meant representation of property. But, you know, modulated a little bit, property and qualities that were, you know, that were desirable in some sense. And the whole point was, how do we come up with a regime that represents the best of society? In other words, broadly privileged elites. Our society, I think, is a representative society. And what does it represent? It represents broadly the interests of the market and of capital. And that is done both in ways that relate to substance and form, and it's very heavily consolidated. Sometimes those interests overlap with some popular interests to some extent, but often they don't. If you accept, as I do, that capital is broadly a system of exploitation based on the command of unpaid labor, the conflict is built into the system. And I think it would be very hard to talk about a capitalist democracy. The terms jar and, you know, should be, I think, we should focus on the differences far more than on the occasional and largely ephemeral overlap. As for Brexit, was it a case of sovereign decision-making? I don't think so if we take the term seriously. It was an expression of an aggregate national opinion, broadly an opinion poll that the actual sovereign, remember in Britain, the sovereign is Parliament. And in fact, specifically, the sovereign is the Queen, kind of incredibly. But Parliament understood as the Queen, the Lords, and the Commons, all mechanisms essentially of representation that broadly reflect the prevailing distribution of power in the realm of the country. You know, in other words, respecting the different class positions and so on. That is the sovereign body. They decided recklessly and stupidly for utterly petty internal Tory politics reasons to consult the nation on this question and to deflect it in ways that allowed for a completely confused response. Some, certainly, people answered the question of, do you want in or out of the EU? Many others used the opportunity to answer quite different questions, as became clear when they were asked about what they really thought they were doing. The critical question that people, I think, hoped for was that they would, to use this phrase that you find all over the world now in Trump and Le Pen and in Finland and Venezuela, take back control. And that is a question of sovereignty. The sovereign is that instance that can command and control, if you like. The question is, who has the power to control the things that people are afflicted by? Who has the power to control global finance? Who has the power to control the outsourcing, you know, all the various processes that have decimated this country, that have made the world really set off on a race to the bottom? Who has the power to control that? Who is the sovereign that could control that? Is it the British Parliament? Is it the British people? Obviously not, I think. The entire notion of a taking back control as a sovereign, you know, assumption of our country or a sovereign power to fight those kinds of forces with our resources, particularly with this government, whose position on these questions is hardly obscure, is a complete fantasy. In that sense, it was absolutely not an instance of sovereign decision-making. And the people who have lined up from Theresa May yesterday or today to all pretty, you know, people like George Monbiot and Owen Jones and many other people saying that the people have spoken, it's the will of the people, the sovereign decision. That, I think, is a really, at best, it's an extremely facile simplification of a much more complicated situation.
Okay, so Edward, we've had some concessions made on this side.
Not
too
many.
On Beatrix's side, not on Peter's side.
Beatrix has said, okay, we live in a democracy, but not in a very good one. Peter, you're holding out. You say that we do indeed not live in a democracy, but we do have some basic freedoms, and we've got this sort of minimal representative government. But we've also had some areas of disagreement, which is really that this neoliberal model, again, this connection between democracy and capitalism, doesn't really offer very much choice. How would you respond to
Well, I remain steadfast on the question of the sovereignty, legitimacy of the referendum. I don't think there is much to dispute there. It can be decided on technical grounds. If your argument were correct, then no election in Britain would be legitimate, but that's false. And this government is not illegitimate. I'm sorry. Just because you disagree with its political views, and I, by the way, as well do, it doesn't follow from that it's illegitimate. It is. We live in a popular democracy, or rather, the population is the sovereign. The parliament is, of course, the representative of that, and this is what happened in the referendum. People were not forced to go to the ballots and vote by force for something. So, I really don't see where you're going with your position.
This government is legitimate in the same way that a mass trade union picket line is illegitimate. In other words, it's legitimate because it reflects the interests of the people who set the laws and decide what is legitimate and what isn't.
No, it also reflects the views of the voters. How can you say that? It reflects the views of those who go to the ballot.
So, come on, some voters. Actually, it's a long time since a British government commanded the majority of the electorate, which is a different thing.
But you are pointing here to a very serious issue, structural issue of democracy, weakness of democracy.
You're not helping us think about what it is, the relationship between, I mean, the issues that you've raised, and I think the thing that you have to acknowledge, really, about the decline of political discourse and political culture in Britain. Okay. This is the thing that I think is the nub of our concerns. Now, what helps us understand why that's happened and what it means and why it is that, certainly in England, England is perceived to be uniquely in these islands a place that is shoddy, kind of really ramshackle. It's not really a culture of democracy that anybody really would go to the stake for, not even Tories. Tories were shocked by what they wrought during Brexit. They're only the most enduring and successful political party we have, so they're very good at saying, blimey, OK, well, on we go, and within 2 days they've put a government together. But that doesn't tell you anything other than that they're very good at putting governments together. The thing that I think is critical here is, what was it that made the conversation during Brexit, that conversation about Europe, be not about Europe?
Sure. I concede all of these.
So we had a referendum that wasn't about the thing that it was about. Sure. Now, you have to answer that paradox. And you have to, you know, you have to then follow through with something, which is that the argument we're having with you is that really the freedom to vote or not vote is not saying a lot. I know that for somebody who didn't have that freedom, it's saying an awful lot. And I honour that experience. I think it's a terrible thing to grow up, live in a society where you are, as a people, as a majority, not trusted, to leave, to come back, to speak. But actually, that's a much more common experience than I think you give credit for. So just the exercise of liberty, I don't know what that means. Liberty and freedom are not terms, to be completely honest, that I really understand. And I doubt whether the average... Anyway, it doesn't help us think about what it was that was so significant and so bad about Brexit.
Now, I'm going to make an executive decision here because I'm conscious we've got about 15 minutes left. We were going to go on to talk about the definition, or sorry, about the question of whether the ideal of democracy can be defended. But I think let's bring in some audience questions because we've got such little time and so such provocative things have been said, and I can see a lot of hands already. There's a lady right at the front in green. Yes. If you wait for the mic, great.
No, I was wondering if the blank, blank votes were counting, if that would not change something.
Okay, great. Let's take a couple in a row. Question about blank votes. Yeah, there's a gentleman there with his hand up.
Hi, yeah, I don't want to put fuel on the fire again, but... We live in a country where everyone sort of is in pretty much agreement that we have a very right-wing media, especially in the print form. And the media in America as well have been very criticized, you know, with their dealing with Trump and things like that. Can you have a democracy without an incredibly responsible and accurate media? And how can we achieve that?
Okay, great. Is there another question perhaps on this side of the room? Yeah, there's a lady with her hand up, kind of halfway up. Oh. Well, let's take this one and then over there. Yep.
Thank you. Can you explain the dangers of equating democracy to capitalism?
I was just going to say, do you think we should assess our democracy, like the bad aspects of our democracy, rather than viewing it like comparatively to see the potential for change and to see if we can actually set a precedent for the other democracies that we have?
Okay, great. Let's take those four and see how we get on. So there's a question about if blank or spoiled votes were counted, would that improve things? A question about can you have a democracy when the media is perceived to be biased? Third question was explaining the dangers of equating democracy and capitalism. And then the last question was to do with how we're supposed to compare different systems and whether we compare ourselves to North Korea or compare ourselves to other countries. Is that...
It's more about like whether you should actually assess the balance, like you should actually look at how to see how the balance is, you should actually look at the
Okay. All right. Good. Well, let's start with that idea of spoiled ballots. Who would like to say something about that?
Don't know. What the answer is.
I mean, in France, they're asking the question. So.
Not competent on it, I'm sorry.
Okay, well, let's move on to the...
Take the question more broadly about voting. Because, of course, if you have to vote for delegates or deputies or people to represent you in some broad sense, then, of course, I would agree with that, but, of course, that you want that process to be free and fair, as everybody likes to say, rather than rigged and corrupt. There's no one's going to argue about this. The question is, democracy, as I'm trying to define it anyway, and I think many people would define it, is about the power of the people, the actual substantive power of the people. Therefore, it does absolutely tap into questions like how informed are people? How does the media actually work? What interests does the media represent? What interests does the education system represent? Why and how, for example, is the educational system interested in replicating class structures or preparing people for a labor market that is indeed, you know, geared around the interests of capital? To address the question of the danger of equating democracy and capitalism, well, the only reason why that question can even come up at all, I think, is that Britain has been relatively lucky to live in a somewhat blunted form of capitalism for the last maybe, I don't know, 80 or 90 years. Blunted because there was a massive mobilization of people to blunt it. You know, out of the trade unions, out of the political groups that took shape out of that, in particular perhaps out of World War II and to some extent exploiting the colonial resources that the country still had, there was, after 1945, you know, a real move to limit the damage that capitalism inflicts. But if you look at the prehistory of British capitalism before that, if you look at capitalism when it's left to do its work unadulterated, you see what it actually is, and it is an infernal system of exploitation. I mean, if you go back and look at what Engels says about the condition of working people in Manchester, or the equivalent text that you have in France at the same time or earlier, or look at the conditions of work in, you know, in Vietnam and Bangladesh and Haiti and China. I mean, take your pick. That's what capitalism means. It has nothing to do with democracy. Capitalism represents the interests of exploitation, pure and simple. If it's in the interest of the exploiters to allow a certain amount of apparent freedom to the people they exploit in the form of a labor contract that you can, quote-unquote, freely sign with your employer, or to indeed to people to pick the blue party or the red party, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, whatever, then they will do so if that helps stabilize things and take the sting out of the danger of popular dissent. But that's it. It will not tolerate for a second something that puts significant structural restrictions on its capacity to exploit. And you can see what it does when, you know, the whole neoliberal reaction is essentially this long process of taking apart those restrictions that were put in place to some extent in the 1950s and 60s.
Edward, would you like to take any
of
these questions?
Well, yes, you cited Engels. I mean, the text by Engels, we know now it has been taken apart by historians of economics, British historians of economics, in the mid-20th century. It's a propagandistic text because we actually know that the Industrial Revolution gave rise, improved the standard of living of workers in Britain compared to their ruler habitats where they came from before. So this needs to be investigated in detail. This is a question of factual detail here. So if you bring in Engels here, personally, I'm not very impressed because I did a bit of research on that. When you say that democracy has nothing to do with capitalism, and you are talking about them, I want to know from you what you actually mean by democracy, because you keep saying democracy is about the popular will and popular... What do you exactly mean by that? And what's... Or let me ask you in a fair way. How would a state look like in your vision, a democratic state on your vision, without capitalism, without private property? And how would that be distinguished from communism?
Well, I think I would defend certain things about communism, including even certain things about actually existing or formally existing communism, without for a second denying the terrible injustices and evils that accompanied it also. But I think that in the Cuban case and in some of the other revolutionary sequences of the 20th century, I think there's still a lot to defend and a lot to learn from, a lot
can
to
you,
criticize.
Can you cite
well?
Some things that we can... Well, I mean, I can cite to you a lot of negative things about communism. I mean, I don't know of a single successful communist state.
For example, Cuba and Haiti are right next to each other in the Caribbean, and I would invite anybody here, maybe some people have had this opportunity, to go from one to the other. And you have a very capitalist example to the east, and you have a somewhat communist example to the left, and I think there's a lot to be said for the communist example to the left, without for a second denying that there are problems too, as you would expect from a country that inherited a highly problematic history that's steeped in structural forms of exploitation.
So why are you then not fair towards liberal democracy? Why not say, okay, we have flaws in our liberal democracy, so why are you not more tolerant towards our system? If you are so tolerant towards communist states, why are you not...
What is my job? This is like a standard Chomsky response. My job is not to point out the...
I have to move away.
Just
just kidding.
It's not my job to point out the problems elsewhere. It's where I live, where I can make some tiny differences to try to draw attention to the problems that we have, and to indeed to assess our democracy as best we can using our own opportunities to do that. I think historically we have episodes. We have the period in the French Revolution of say 1792 into 93. We have the Paris Commune. We have some of the revolutionary sequences in the 20th century. We have some of the anti-colonial movements. We have some all kinds of forms of grassroots organization, council-led movements, and so on. We have some recent experience in Bolivia, in Ecuador, to some extent in Venezuela, still, however, embattled that is now. There's a lot to draw on, and those are examples for me of broadly of popular empowerment, always fighting, of course, against the grain, against massive forms of entrenched power. These stories, you see what happens when those conflicts become militarized and turn into armed conflict, the story becomes very ugly. So, of course, you can always refer to the consequences of those scenarios and say, well, look, they led to civil war, they led to bloodshed, look at Syria, look at look at many of the examples you might want to refer to. For me, that's an instance of the degree to which a powerful elite will go to protect itself. And unfortunately, the annals of history are written in the absolute butchery of these scenarios. And you can see it in pretty much every example I can think of.
Well, a power elite...
Here,
wait a second. Just one sentence. A powerful elite that defends itself, that's for me... the Stalinist regime, the Leninist regime, Ceausescu, Mao, Pol Pot, the 100 million victims killed by communist regimes. It's, you're exactly describing this success story of communism.
No, yeah. I'm not defending Stalin.
And none of them have been successful.
Edward, I don't think he did, and I certainly wouldn't. And... and you have to believe me because I was, and in some sense remain, a communist. I think that the experience of communism in the majority of the states where it was introduced has been pretty disastrous. Disastrous in the sense that even though, in China, the gender gap, let me give you an example. The gap between men and women's earnings and levels of exploitation was probably one of the smallest in the world in 1979 when China fell in love with capitalism. It's now regarded by some of its own economists as a society which is the mother of all redistributions. Tell me, somebody, why capitalism's introduction in China has to produce this awesome acceleration of awesome inequality. Why the Confucian form of communist capitalism in China is so authoritarian and renders... at the moment I have to say I'm reading Chief Inspector Chen. Have you read Chief Inspector Chen thrillers? They're a lovely insight into the ordinary little nooks and crannies and lanes of contemporary neo-communist capitalism, or is it capitalist communism, or whatever it is. Anyway, the harmonious state where yet another form of authoritarianism prevails since the introduction of capitalism. However, I want to say something about here that is really important, I think, for you, Edward. It seems that we're having an argument with you. One of the things that's really important about our history and why we get to this is that by the end of the 60s and the 1970s, something is happening to British socialism and British labour movement organisation that is really important to get. It's really, really important to get. There was a huge debate on the British left, characterised by an article called The Forward March of Labour Halted by Eric Hobsbawm. Marxism Today was inaugurated a large conversation about the crisis of British socialism. I think that crisis, and it's salient to the conversation that we're having, was partly to do with the way in which British labourism was always patriarchal. It was never actually particularly egalitarian. It wasn't a model of a good society. It was a model of ranked assemblies of men working men, some of them honourable, asserting their interests at the expense largely of women in the name of equality. We never actually had a culture that was egalitarian in Britain. It never therefore became an exemplar of what a good society, a solidaristic society, would look like. Municipal socialism tended to be buses and barracks. I won't bore us now with what that conversation was, but it's very important to pay attention to it, because it was about the disappointment with what Labourism had delivered, which was huge but limited. And into that disappointment marches neoliberalism. The neoliberal, the globalisation moment converges with an experience of the limits of British Labourism. And that collision really disempowered, and ultimately, in any case, it was defeated by Thatcherism. You can't underestimate that either. British Labourism was defeated, roundly defeated. Defeated. It didn't just kind of internally combust. It was defeated. And part of the conditions of its defeat were to do with the limits of its own agenda, its profoundly patriarchal internal culture, which meant that it could never, as it were, speak for the whole nation. Now, that then takes us to what the aftermath of the Thatcherite and the social democratic endorsement of neoliberal takes us to. I'll end with one little remark about the impoverishment of our political culture, and it's in this. Maybe a year ago, I was invited to take part in any questions on the wireless. And it happened to be in the week when there were some embarrassing statistics for our current Prime Minister and the previous Prime Minister about immigration statistics. Their pledge to abolish immigration had failed, and so this was allegedly a very embarrassing moment. And I got called on a Thursday to say, oh, really sorry, would you mind? We've got this big immigration thing this week. Would you stand down for another time, because we really need to get UKIP on? What did that mean? It meant that UKIP was the default representative of a conversation in Britain about immigration, and indeed, you know, the proxy for a conversation about race. So I'm not allowed on the wireless, just as a person, as it happens in this case, you know, a feminist and a green, to talk about immigration, because I don't know about immigration, do I? UKIP knows about immigration. That tells you everything you need to know about why we got to Brexit. Because UKIP, I'm not saying that it didn't have resonance in popular feeling, it did. But the argument against it was demobilised by a media that was entranced by UKIP.
I think we're going to have to call it to a close, I'm afraid. We could go on for a lot longer. Just before I do, you'll notice that in front of you there's a short survey. One of the ways that the people on this panel are able to get funding for their research is to show that it's made an impact outside the academic sphere. So if it's made an impact on you, feel free to say so, and just leave your paper on the table rather than handing it back. Leave it where it is. So thank you so much to all of our panelists.